Yeah, started getting involved in Dr. Hanna's correspondence.
Yeah.
And he recommended that I talk with you, that you could give me...
Hohenhardt.
Yeah. That you could give me a feel for Dr. Hanna as a person, as an administrator, because I just knew him as a student. Mm-hmm. And that you could give me a feel for some of the things that happened from a sort of an observer position of how the University College functioned and, mm-hmm. and what your feelings were about it, pro and con, because I need to hear both sides. What I'm going to try to do is a comparison of the University College to the Harvard model and to the UCLA model. And at this point, I have no idea which is going to look like the better one.
I don't know. I've forgotten about the Harvard model. I never did know the UCLA. Well, I'll be glad to talk to you about Hanna.
I thought the best way we could do it, if it's okay with you, is just tell me a little bit about yourself. Just start out how you came to Michigan State, how you met Dr. Hanna. And just as you're telling me about yourself, I can ask you a few questions.
Well, I did my graduate work at Chicago, served in the Navy, went to Ohio State where I taught for 12 years, mm-hmm. came here in 58 in the history department mm-hmm. to teach American foreign relations. And I had done some writing on the China question. And I did know something about University College when I came and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
wholly unfamiliar. Dr. Hanna was a remarkable man. One other president of a Big Ten university said to me, the greatest university president in the 20th century. That may be too strong, but he was one of the greats. Another colleague of mine, Russell Nye, when he spoke of John Hanna, said, glorious common sense. And I think that was the key.
Mm-hmm.
He had, most important, Michigan State was a mission to John Hanna. He wasn't looking for other positions. Michigan State was a cause completely dedicated to the university. He was not a self-seeking man or ambitious politician. He was kept his finger on everything. He knew what was going on. Some people thought he was authoritarian. I never did. My dealings with him did not support that charge. I found him easy to talk to, a good listener, asked good questions, and he was not authoritarian in any bold sense. But he was a strong leader.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I have found in the research is that in many ways he kind of took the idea and created the University College with Dr. Floyd Reeves kind of running the spearhead for him. Did you get to meet and work with Dr. Reeves at all?
No, I met Dr. Reeves. Reeves came from Chicago. Chicago had the college, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They called the college. And, of course, this place became so much larger than Chicago, so the problem wasn't quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
His idea, I think Hanna was concerned about freshmen and sophomores getting good teaching and attention. And, with that part of it, I had great sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty was that the man who went into University College, of course, taught the same course throughout their career.
Yeah, I kind of got that feeling.
And that was they wouldn't necessarily admit this, but it was stultifying. Partly through their own fault, partly through the fault of the rest of us, they came to feel like second-class citizens on the faculty. And that was not due to differences in salary or promotion, just that they were, in a sense, isolated from the rest of us. Mm-hmm. Then, what really killed University College more than any other one thing, sometime, probably 64 or 65, due to the fact that they wanted to teach other courses, were permitted to design courses that they would teach aside from the so-called general education course. And the result was that many of those courses were more specialized, for instance, in history, than our graduate courses in history.
You're kidding.
And when they lost interest in what they call general education and work this in, that was not only duplication, but very bad.
Sort of a battle for territory between them, yeah, and the other departments that weren't in the way.
There was no reason to permit that to happen, but it did happen. And a friend of mine who was in University College, a man I greatly respect, testifies that that's what killed it.
Can you share with me who it is? I might want to interview him if I could.
Well, his name is John Reinhold. He lives on the outskirts of, if you go out Abbott Road all the way. He's a very thoughtful person, a good historian, just a fine man. Mm-hmm. And they had many good people.
For sure.
And like the rest, they had some poor and inadequate.
Welcome to the human race.
They had a number of people like John who were dedicated to the idea of what the mission they had. Mm-hmm. Now, by splitting up and doing other things that were more specialized, they were repudiating their mission.
Their existence, yeah.
I don't think John ever taught one of those specialized courses, but many of them did. And that was very unfortunate. I think some of the courses were more successful than others in University College. They started with some courses that they eliminated. American Thought and Language was originally a communications course, and then it was an effort to combine American history and reading and writing. Well, I found in my own case, my students did more writing than the students did in American Thought and Language.
Yeah.
I don't suppose that was true in every case, but because I probably gave more written work than most people. Now, one of the issues in the eyes of some might be that the cost was high. Now, at a place like Ohio State, the English department. English was taught largely by graduate assistants. And incidentally, because they had very close supervision and a marvelous head by the name of Hildreth, they did a good job. When you put full professors in to teach a freshman course, of course they're higher paid, and then the graduate student class is smaller. your cost goes up. But what actually happened was that the cost per student in some of those departments was higher than in our English department, which taught graduate students. And why that should have been, I don't know. But that I know is a fact. It became, I think, eventually after I left the teenship, lost touch, that the cost of running it became a question. Can you afford to do this? Is it necessarily better? It isn't necessarily better. At Chicago, graduate students taught that course. But they, too, were carefully supervised and instructed and worked over every lesson they ever taught.
So you think the cost could have been managed if it was really the thing that they said it was?
Well, I don't know why their costs, they were not terribly high, but the fact that they were higher.
Do you think it might have been used as an excuse, a cover, a sort of face-saving mechanism?
No, I don't think so. I'm not sure why that happened, but it did happen.
I'm hoping to meet with ex-president Mackey and ask, because he was basically the president when they finally disbanded it. And that's a pointed question.
Yeah, well, it was still a question when a new man, who's here now, came. And he spoke someplace or other. This is the second or third hand report, said it was just too expensive. Now, they have not disbanded American Thought and Language. That's still going.
Yeah.
But it's, my feeling was that those four departments should have been in respective colleges. Social science and College of Social Science. History and English. The humanities course should have been in history. And ideally, they should not have been two separate staffs. See?
If you had to do it over again, let's say that someone had come to you in 64 and said, they've come up with this idea, but we can see it hurting the program. Could you give us an alternative?
Well, my alternative at the moment was to break up the college, which was a separate administrative cost. But that wasn't my purpose. My purpose was to, the humanities on a campus like this should not be in competition or fighting each other. They should be working together. And the only way you can achieve that is that you do not have a separate staff.
What do you think of the idea of, if you were to maintain the University College separate and have the professors rotating out of their department in for a couple of years and then rotating back, something that like they have with the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
Some of that was done, but it never worked, really. Roy Matthews and some others in University College did, from time to time, teach in history. There were two men in ATL who moved to the English department, but those were isolated cases.
I'm talking more of a systematic, where people would know that they would serve so many years in one department and then they would swing over to the other.
Here's
that might eliminate that second-class citizenship.
And it's not, I came as a full professor. And I came because I could teach American foreign relations. And that meant working day and night doing research and publishing. For me to go over there and teach their course, which was essentially European history, which I had done some teaching in at Ohio State, would have taken all my time, I wouldn't have come.
Good point.
Now, Richard Sullivan, first class medievalist, and a great friend of mine, did teach the first part of the humanities course a number of times, not regularly. And he could do that without all kinds of new preparation. Most of us could not.
One of the things I noticed, and it's funny because I noticed it as a student, and then just recently as I've been reading books, Dressel's book and a few others on how things were constructed, it supports a feeling that I had at the time, that with the exception of the humanities department, the others were survey courses, broadly based, trying to bring in many different disciplines into an overall umbrella. Whereas the humanities course was, as you said, another history department.
Not quite true. That course was different from the department's course in European history, in that they did more reading in the literature of the period.
My point being is it isn't so much, you know, I'm not disagreeing with you on that part, but they didn't bring in a lot of philosophy and a lot of the arts, a lot of the other things. They didn't make it an umbrella humanities course, whereas natural science seemed to be an umbrella course.
I don't know much about the natural science course. Well, when you offer a year's course in Western civilization,
yeah, that bothered me. There was only
meeting
one year.
3 days a week. There just isn't the time.
Agreed.
Before I ever came here, and while I was at Ohio State, and had no thought of coming here, I was asked to make a study of the humanities course. And it was essentially the Western civilization course taught all over the place. We embarked on a new course at Ohio State at the time, combining American and European history. But we covered from the 13th century, and we did not cover all of Europe from 13. We covered all of Europe only after the French Revolution. As a result, when we studied the Renaissance, instead of 1 or 2 days on it, we spent a week on it, and 5 days a week. If we studied the Reformation, we spent enough time on the Reformation to make it meaningful. When you cover too much, it becomes superficial, and it becomes a matter of memorizing rather than understanding.
I took my cognate courses on the graduate level in history, and one of them was on the Reformation, and I just could not believe how much had transpired during that time.
Yeah.
It was like walking into a forest for the first time as a biologist on a different planet. I mean, the species of animals were incredible. It was
well, there are pros and cons. Now, Columbia was the one that started this, you know, after World War One, and Chicago picked it up. And I think the Chicago courses were very good. Now, this social science course was called Contemporary Society. And while I was a graduate student at Chicago, I taught at a private school and taught contemporary society using the Chicago manual, and it was an excellent course. Originally, the social science course here put out a book of readings that was really very good, and I think influenced by the Chicago thing. It was an awful hard thing to teach.
I was going to ask what, having come from Chicago yourself, as Floyd Reeves did, how much of an influence the Chicago school had on the original establishment of the University College here.
I had always assumed that it was Floyd Reeves, but some people questioned that. But somehow Hannah met Floyd Reeves, who was a dynamic, a rather exciting fellow, you know, big name, and brought him here. But I'm not sure that if you check the dates when Reeves came and when University College was established, you might find that it wasn't really Floyd Reeves.
I suspected that in some of the things that I've read, that that Hannah's, I saw his, as I call it, his thumbprint.
I think it was probably John Hanna.
And that his, that Reeves kind of ran interference for him, but it was basically Hanna's concept. And I have no problem with that.
Reeves had nothing to do with it. Once they set up the courses and the time I was here, Reeves had no connection with it at all. Hanna had a great idea, but the way it worked out, it did not work out well.
Yeah.
Of course, people in the upper division, which is what it was called at Chicago, they were doing a lot of research. Some few people in University College did some research, pretty small number, and there was no premium on research.
Mm-hmm.
Publication. And I think when you teach the same course and you get to be age 45, there's great danger you lose interest and enthusiasm. Many of them did. That can happen.
We call it burnout now. Yeah. That's one of the concerns that I have, because I'm hoping once I have compared the three models to come up with some suggestions. And that's why I was asking you for your input on what would you have done if you had been the dean, because getting ideas from people.
Deans don't have that much authority, really.
True, but let's pretend for a second. Yeah.
Well, the first mistake they make, I think, general education. What is general education? Why is American Thought and Language or the humanities course general education, but my course in foreign affairs is not?
Good point.
General education is a very questionable term that's hard to define.
Especially now, after what's happened in the last year. I bet you've been having a real interesting time trying to figure out a lot of what's going to happen in foreign diplomacy now that the Russians have, in essence, admitted communism doesn't work.
Well, I kept busy writing. Mm-hmm. And I wrote two books while I was dean, which is unheard of, I guess. And I've written three since I retired, so.
And I'm glad you retired and slowed down.
Well, I enjoyed it. That's why I did it, you know.
Nothing wrong with that.
If you don't like it, if writing is difficult for you, writing is never easy. Never was for me, but some people just find it just too much. And a lot of that's written is highly specialized and too specialized. But it was a good experiment, and but the mistake they made was to offer these specialized courses, because that was, in a sense, denying what their mission was.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of those.
They literally walked into the hands of their opponents.
Yeah. That's my feeling.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I have not reached that point in my research where I've spotted that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's interesting that it happened just as I was leaving the university.
Yeah.
That explains a lot of what happened. And of course, Hannah was
still
also getting ready to leave.
Those courses, you know. But part of their teaching load was in these other fields, their special interest field.
I'm surprised, well, of course, it was during his last couple of years, but I'm surprised that Dr. Hannah had gone along with it.
Well, a president of a university cannot tell specialists what they ought to teach. You know? Hannah was not an intellectual. You know? He was a very bright man. And that should have been worked out through the course and curriculum committee, really. They should have denied it. Mm-hmm. But the pressure was so great from university college that they gave in on it.
Would you think that maybe also, with considering the time frame and his involvement in civil rights, that might have also taken some of the attention away from it?
No. An amazing man.
Really?
Oh, we'd have breakfast at 6:30 in the morning. He would have been up and fed his chickens and read the New York Times and the Free Press and go to work. And we'd have one day, I remember academic council, we met till 6 o'clock. He left at 10 at 6 because he was going to Washington for a meeting on civil rights. And without Father Hesburgh and John Hanna, Civil Rights Commission would never have been what it was. Hanna and Hesburgh made that. Hanna had a big part of it.
That's Ruth Jameson.
He felt very strongly about civil rights.
God bless him.
He was very sincere about that. He had also this great, which came out of the war, the international point of view, which is commendable. But John Hanna's idea of international relations was sending people from agriculture or specialists overseas to help in terms of diplomacy and foreign affairs. I don't like to say anything against Hanna, but I'm a great admirer. He was not informed. He was very interested in students taking foreign language, which worked to my benefit as dean. And our foreign language department, when I came here, was absolutely a disgrace. And it's a very respectable department by now. I'm not claiming credit for all that, but I was the one who broke up the department and put greater emphasis on it. But you can't be in touch with everything in a place like this.
Oh, for sure.
But Hanna knew an awful lot, was he, and he knew students. When I first came here, he called students by name, knew something about them, amazing. And there was another side of Hanna, and this is not for the tape recorder.
I only met Dr. Hanna once, but just that one time, just it said so much to me about him as a human being. It was my graduation day, and I was walking down the sidewalk between the old Union Hall and where his residence was. I had my robes on. I had my two brothers with me, who, of course, being younger than me, thought I was God's gift to life. They've learned since how wrong that is. But he didn't help the situation for them. As we were coming down the street, up he came with another gentleman, and he stopped, introduced himself, and the gentleman, which he didn't need to introduce himself to me, but he did, and he asked about me and talked with me for a few minutes, and then
that was John Hanna.
Yeah, he went on. Well, it was Chief Justice Earl Warren he was with.
Really?
I mean, my head is spinning with the two of them took time to talk to me. Can you imagine my two brothers? I mean, I was walking on water as far as they were concerned, because he treated me as if he knew me.
That's right.
And my brothers just were like, you know the president of the university? And he introduced us to the Chief Justice.
He called me when I was dean in the early years. And some question of students being appointed to something or other. He'd tell me all about them. He knew more about them than I did.
Just his, that common touch.
Of course, as it got so big, that declined.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has to be 40,000. Yeah. There were 40,000 students on campus when I was here. And, you know,
what years were you here?
62 to 65. I transferred in as a transfer student, spent 3 years here, and then graduated. I caught the tail end of the university college. And history, I was a double major, history and math.
Oh,
and picked up a deep love of Orientalism from here. In fact, it has not gone away since I've been here.
Did you have Walter Fee?
No, I didn't. I wish I had, because I've been reading one book he has, and his eloquence just amazes me. But I had a Chinese gentleman. I forgot his name. And
Guan Huai So.
That's who. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so as soon as you said so, I remember.
He's retired, lives in San Diego.
Hmm.
Nice
but
man.
He every year, once in the term, he would take his whole class home to his house and have Chinese dinner for
us.
I had never tasted Chinese food in my life.
And it was good.
Was it good? I'm cursed ever since. I've got to live where there's a Chinese restaurant now. I mean, you know.
Was a fine man.
Just open my eyes to things. I learned so much here. Give you an example of why I like the University College. I came from a small town in Wyoming called Green River, and I didn't even know, living there, that we were part in ancient geological times of the Great Green River Basin. Didn't know that. Never understood or knew why you could go anywhere where I was at and find skeletons.
Well,
fossils, I mean, until I got here.
All of us become specialists to some extent, or at least limited in our range. And as you, I know, for instance, in my, thanks to my research in the field of history, I have read much less in the way of fiction than I did at one time.
I have only one weakness in that area, and that's science fiction. I love to read science fiction, but other than that, military history is an absolute fascination of mine. And I love history anytime I can get my hands on it.
Now, you're at Akron.
Yes, sir.
They had a man in the diplomatic history by the name of Warren Keel, K-U-E-L, who died some years ago. And I knew Warren very well, and I know Lawrence Kaplan of Kemp State very well. Very both excellent people.
Well, I had a Dr. Baker in Reformation. In fact, he's supposed to be an expert in the area.
Uh-huh.
And I had a Dr. Zagrando in American history in the Civil Rights era.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because how things come together.
Mm-hmm.
Because I took the course in American history because I was involved in the Civil Rights Movement on the fringe, being just recently baptized to it, as I was as an 18-year-old. And there's where I began to see Dr. Henson.
There is a man who, at the moment I can't think of his name, although I know him well, but he wrote a book on Hannah and the Civil Rights, which is very well known. He is no longer living here. He moved to Columbus a year ago.
Oh, you mean Dr. Neal?
Neal.
Yeah, I've got the book, and I've interviewed Dr. Neal.
Niehaus is a very fine fellow.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
And his account of the civil rights, and Foster Ray Dulles also wrote a book. You know, he came here for a quarter and spent time with the Hanna papers and wrote on Hanna and civil rights.
See, now, I didn't know that Dr. Dulles, but Dr. Niehaus has given me, gave me his most recent book that he did. And I've been trying to get to that one. That's one of my many books I've got to do in the next couple of months. But, he's been extremely helpful and opened up a lot of doors for me.
He's a very nice fellow.
Yes, he is. Well, I enjoyed this time. I really appreciated the input. You've given me some good insight here, some things that I did not realize.
Yeah,
and
well,
I appreciated that.
I try not to just be prejudiced, but obviously, you know, my loyalty was arts and letters.
Yeah, for sure.
And the dean at University College wasn't always very happy with.
You've got to protect your own turf, and that's respected.
Yeah.
See, it's only through hearing every side of the coin that you get a better picture of what the coin's all about. And I don't want to go out and write a paper and possibly have it published and then be eaten alive because I didn't catch both sides.
Yeah.
That's not the scholarly thing to do.
Well, and back of all these programs, Harvard and Columbia and Chicago, with the hope of giving these first 2 years, they shouldn't specialize when they come.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And now you can do that either by university college, but you can also do it the district requirement of distribution.
I think the question then becomes, through that distribution requirement, does the final product come out the way you want it to come out?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the question I'm debating in my own mind.
It's,
because I have the same problem as the superintendent of schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I get the kids to diversify?
Yeah.
You know, kids everywhere. And I was just as guilty as the next. We'll look for the easy way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we sink to our lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate.
Well, you get...
Until you learn.
Like the School of Music, which is good here. Not the best in the country, but it's very good. The musicians think that students who come here to study music shouldn't study anything else. You know.
Yeah.
It takes all the time to prepare them.
You know, an engineer who doesn't think the same way about engineering?
Yeah, sure.
And the tragedy is they suffer for it, and so does our country.
Yeah.
I know. That's the thing I fight constantly
mm-hmm.
as a superintendent trying to get programs in. When you have boards of education, where if you're lucky, you've got high school diplomas on your board mm-hmm. of education, and they just don't grasp what you're trying to do with the kids. You're trying to give them that,
yeah.
that broad base that they can make some halfway intelligent decisions from.
Yeah.
But having, you know, to talk about a 15-year-old specializing is absurd to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely absurd. And yet, you know, you're running into the same problem with 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
I think that's what got me interested in doing the curriculum mm-hmm. model rather than some other things. But I'd like
mm-hmm.
to, down the road, really get into Dr. Hanna myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm just amazed at some of the things I've seen about him. But like I said, I really appreciate everything, Dr. Bark.
Well, you're very welcome.
Appreciate it.